For those of you who know me personally, you know my younger brother is on the autism spectrum. And while he is high functioning and doing very well in his 30s, living alone in Florida and thriving, I'm always curious when I see that new studies or new research has been released and it has to do with the population of people who are autistic. And I came across something that really piqued my interest. Apparently, Yale just published some important results in Nature Molecular Psychiatry. It says for the first time, researchers used this PET, PET imaging, to detect differences in synapses observed in autistic and non-autistic adults. I have absolutely no idea what that means. So that's why we're having the doctors come on to talk about this, because I want to know if these new differences being detected in autism, what do the results mean? Could it pave a better way to support the, you know, people who are in this population? Could it mean earlier intervention? So we want to find out more about this. We have Dave Matusky here, who is the collaborator and co-lead of this research study, joining us now. Dave, thank you so much for your time. So first of all, what is synapsis? I don't know what that means.
Sure. Thanks for having us on. And so synapses are really the junctions between nerve cells or neurons. And we all have them, all animals really do. And that's really kind of like the gap, if you would. It's also a way to kind of measure the amount of neurons or those nerve cells in the brain in general.
Okay. So this is looking at brain activity in layman's terms.
Similar to activity, it's in a way you can say it's the amount of cells in the brain. So it's kind of like the amount of a particular, you know, neuron or cell in the brain.
Okay. And then let's talk about PET imaging. Again, it says positron emission tomography. For those who are not familiar with that, what is this?
Sure. So positron emission tomography, so it really what it is it's an ability for us to look at molecules in the brain. In a way, you could almost think of it as like kind of like painting by numbers as we did with kids or something like that. And so each one of these, scans has a tracer. And what that tracer is it's really the way I describe it is some folks, it's like a little bit of medicine. And you inject that into somebody and it kind of jumps onto a target. And then you're able to see through the amount of really physics and chemistry what is the underlying structure of the brain.
Okay.
In a sense, I always say I find it amazingly interesting. In a sense, it's almost like it's this perfect marriage of physics and chemistry, all that kind of wrapped up together to be able to give us this view that we really wouldn't be able to see with other technologies.
Wow. And do people, not to sound morbid, but I'm thinking to myself, whenever I hear about like scans or things going on with the human brain, especially football players, it usually happens post-mortem. Right. Are people able to have these scans done while they're alive, or is this after people pass?
No, it's a great question. This can happen alive. And I think that's what makes it really, really interesting. There's a lot of those studies, like you said, are after folks are deceased or the postmortem, and that gives us information, but it also limits us, right? And at that point, somebody is already deceased. There's already processes that are happening. So here, this is in living, breathing people, but other animals too. So we're able to do that.
So as Dave Matusky just said, this is really some monumental, I think, research and findings that are coming out of these scans and this imaging, I should say. And so that's where Dr. James McPartland comes in, who also is here on the air with the Child Study Center at Yale School of Medicine. Why is this such a big deal, Dr. McPartland?
It's a big deal because right now, despite so much study over so many years, we understand so little about what's actually different in the brain in a molecular and structural way that is related to the differences that we see in autism. And part of the reason that we don't know that is there's very limited tools, as Dave was saying, to let you look at these in living human beings. And so what we're seeing here really for the first time in autism is a very concrete, specific difference in the way a brain is built that we can see that is different on average in people with autism. But what's really important, and honestly, we're surprised by the strength of these relations is really, really strongly associated with the differences, that the specific differences that people with autism report in their experience, and that clinicians who have evaluated people with autism see as differences. So we're really seeing a link, we're seeing a really concrete brain difference with a very specific link to the behavioral differences, which is really an advance for us.
So, Dr. McPartland, are you able to see these differences early on, like when they're infants, when they're toddlers? I mean, because I would imagine that's the big deal here, is if you can spot these differences earlier or younger, it would mean you could give better support, get interventions sooner rather than later for these children.
That would be a goal, Melissa. We, right now, these technologies, because they involve a lot, you have to be able to tolerate a lot to undergo one of these scans, we only do them in adults in
okay.
this first study. But Dave and his colleagues have actually developed new technologies that are much more tolerable. So that's exactly what we plan to do, is to understand them and to understand whether these differences are evident in younger autistic people. A challenge for us is that when we see this kind of difference in adults, we can't know for sure whether this is something that is kind of the genesis of autism, or is something that is just a reflection of having different experiences over the course of, you know, your life as an autistic person.
Pretty incredible research happening right here in our listening area. A Yale team just published important results in Nature Molecular Psychiatry. And for the first time, researchers used positron emission topography, also known as PET imaging, to detect differences in synapses observed in autistic and non-autistic adults. And basically, what's exciting about this is that you're able to look at these nerves, it sounds like, in the brain, and it could mean in the future we're able to see these differences in autism, and how the results could then pave the way for maybe more support and interventions earlier on. Now, right before the break, Dr. McPartland, you had said that the PET imaging is only for adults right now, but that Dave, who is also here, Dave Metusky, who is the collaborator and co-lead on this research study, you're working on ways to use the imaging for younger patients. Dave, what's the likelihood of finding that solution very soon? And the reason I say that is because right now, we are sort of in a broken sort of education system where we're not getting kids intervention early enough. And a lot of that comes down to the dollars to have them tested, with, I would say, more of like almost like tests that you would do in school, not brain tests, but like written tests. But I'm
right.
wondering, you know, do you think that this imaging will become available soon for younger patients?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we certainly hope so. I mean, I am also a neuropsychiatrist, right? And so I always think the thing that separates my field from some of the other medical fields, like if you go to cardiology or if you go to a pulmonologist, is that they have concrete tests. You're able to know whether or not you have this condition. I think that's what makes psychiatry so hard, is that we don't really have these really kind of like, you know, concrete diagnoses where someone can come in, they can see something, and then they know they have it, and then they leave. So that's really kind of one of the goals of my career, really, is to try to say, okay, can we push that along? I certainly would hope this would be one of those things. Now, the actual technology to do that, so PET involves radiation, right? And we didn't really get into that fully. And so that's one of those limitations in it.
Oh, so I didn't realize that. Okay.
Does.
I can see. All right. That's the concern there. Got it.
Yeah.
Got
that's what the technology is based on. You know, how much radiation, it varies, and it might even be less than like kind of like a local X-ray, but still it involves that amount of radiation. So the question is then, how low can we go? Can we bring that radiation down to very, very low levels? And so we're lucky at Yale that we have the next generation of a PET scanner. We call it the NeuroExplorer, the NX. And what we're able to do there is we're able to get this the increased sensitivity, right? So up to maybe tenfold better than anywhere else in the world right now. And the hope is that also translates to a much lower dose. And so we're able to give a very, very small dose of that PET tracer, and therefore to be a lot less radiation. That plus this new, I mean, I'm sure all your listeners know AI or artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. and that's really become a revolution now in everything, including in. So between a very, amazingly new scanner, along with some AI techniques, we're hoping to really get that dose incredibly low to the point where it might be say this is the selling point. We want a plane ride to Disney World, right? Some folks might not realize when you jump on a plane, because at a higher altitude, you actually have an increase in radiation. So if we get it to that low level, I think that opens up a whole wide range for infants and for kids and for everyone else.
I mean, it does. And again, Dr. Matusky, I when I was looking, you know, up your profile, it also mentions that you're the medical director of the Yale Pet Center. So I mean, I know you get this technology, obviously, and what it could do. But I'm thinking to myself, I just remember with my younger brother in the 90s when he was diagnosed with autism. I mean, even my own son, who's 6 years old, and we're still trying to determine, does he need interventions in school? I don't believe he's autistic. But I do, you know, you wonder things like, you know, are you dyslexic? Things like that. And that's being looked at. But, you know, one of the biggest issues I hear from education officials here and across the country is that we're not getting intervention early enough for these kids. So by the time they're in third grade, you've already established that they don't feel good about themselves. They've been bullied or they feel like they're behind. We've made this huge gap. And I'm wondering if this could really be monumental, influential in getting, you know, them the interventions that they need earlier on. Now, this looks at specifically autism. Does it also look at any of the other differences, or is this specific to autism?
It's not specific to autism. And so we run a whole host of studies, myself and a lot of friends and collaborators. And so really it looks at any brain disorder. As a neuropsychiatrist, I always say, I can't think of a disorder I'm interested in that does not involve synapses, that they all do. So I think that you know, we've established this in Alzheimer's and other dementias and Parkinson's and those kinds of things. I think the thing that, you know, it's really fun to team up with Jamie on this is that, you know, in autism, we haven't had as much of that kind of evidence because we haven't had the tool really to be able to look at this. And so I think this gives us a new ability, kind of like Galileo with the telescope or more recently with the James Webb. We just have this, you know, ability to look deep inside the brain with relevant molecules. I think that's what really, you know, to me, hopefully this can be a part of a revolution in the field.
I think it could be. And it really would save, like I said, a lot of money on testing and families having to, you know, be behind the eight ball a little bit, because those signs are not as obvious as we would like them to be, or not obvious enough that schools will just pay for the interventions or having resources made available to your kids like OT and things of that nature. So I'm excited to see what the future will hold, and I really hope to stay in touch with both of you, Dr. James McPartland, as well as Dr. Dave Matusky. Thank you both so much for coming on to talk about this. I'm excited to see what the future holds.
Thank you, Martha.
Thank you both. I really appreciate it. No, not a problem at all.